I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. John Stewart surprised, shocked, even saddened a lot of people last week when he announced that he was leaving The Daily Show after 17 years as host. Here's some of what he said.
17 years is the longest I have ever in my life held a job by 16 years and 5 months. Thank you. The upshot there being, I am a terrible employee. But in my heart, I know it is time for someone else to have that opportunity. And that I told you they didn't know. You probably know. Not right away. It's going to be, we're still working out details. I'm up in September, might be around then, might be December, might be July. We're still working out details. I don't have any specific plans. Got a lot of ideas. I got a lot of things in my head. I'm going to have dinner on a school night with my family, who I have heard from multiple sources are lovely people.
Stewart and his partner in satire, Stephen Colbert, who ended his show in December, have had a big impact on the country, skewering politicians and the press who have given them plenty of material to work with. We asked Sophia McLennan to join us to discuss the power of satire, parody, and mockery. Her book asks this question: is satire saving our nation? She's a professor in international affairs and comparative literature at Penn State University, a founding director of the Center for Global Studies. She writes regularly for Salon and Huffington Post and joins us from the studios of Penn State University. And Sophia McLennan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
I found it so interesting last week that people seem to be more upset about Jon Stewart leaving The Daily Show than Brian Williams being put on a six-month hiatus. What does that tell us?
Well, you know, you really had such a week with those two events happening side by side. I think that what it really tells us is that Jon Stewart had become such a vital source of news information to the U.S. public. And it was a very particular source of news because it was satirical news. And frankly, Brian Williams feels more replaceable than Jon Stewart.
It is interesting, and others have talked about this as well, how a show that has touted itself as a fake news show became this trusted news source. And I was wondering, is the show that good, or is real news that bad?
The answer is both, right? Real news is, in fact, that bad. And again and again in the last, say, 7 or 8 years, we've had surveys by the Pew Research Center and other places that consistently showed that viewers of Colbert and The Daily Show knew more about current issues than people who watched news on television. It was consistent. There was never a study that went the other way.
And what does that tell you then?
Well, there's a lot of things. And, you know, in order to keep the answer relatively short, one of the big things that happened was that news media has radically changed on television. It changed in a big way when we started with a 24/7 channel like CNN. That was a big shift because you had to figure out how to fill that time. And once that happened, it started to get less serious. Other shifts that happened were, you know, the kind of the partisan nature of cable news, where you now have CNN sort of in the middle, MSNBC on the left, Fox on the right. That's not good for viewers. So we've seen a number of key shifts in how news media works. And then meanwhile, the satirists were able to speak truth in the face of some of the silly news that we were seeing on cable. And they were able to become more and more successful. It's a first for satire. Satire used to always sort of come after one would consume the news. And it became the case that it flipped. It started to be people's primary source.
And how do you define satire? How should we understand what it is and how it works?
Well, that's a great question. The very simple thing that makes satire so special is that it has a layer of irony, right? So it never speaks exactly what it means. It's not literal. It has an extra layer of meaning. So for Jon Stewart, it simply could be that he would show a clip of news and then he would point at it and look quizzically at you and say, really? So he doesn't have to say, wow, can you believe that those guys just said that on news? He doesn't say that. The viewer intuits it, right? So that kind of layer of figurative meaning, puns, irony, all those metaphors that satirists use, they actually make the brain work harder to get the point. And because of that, they become a vital form of information for the public. It just encourages critical thinking.
And I was thinking about this because it is not cynicism. I mean, cynicism says, forget about it. There's nothing you can do about it. But there seems to be sort of an undercoat of optimism in satire.
Well, that isn't always true, but yes. I mean, certainly for Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, these were two comedians that were very, very committed to our country and to democracy. When they did the rally on the National Mall, it was all about trying to get people to realign how they were thinking about politics. But there are comedians that can be just sort of mean. They can be satirical, and also the snark gets too harsh. And that can just leave people dejected. So satire is a weird thing because depending on where you are in the political spectrum, I've talked to people who thought that Stephen Colbert was just viciously attacking the Republicans all the time. That's not how I saw it, but I can see how they felt that way. So sometimes it's about perspective.
And some people thought that Stephen Colbert was for real. They didn't understand that this was an act.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. There's research studies by communication scholars that found that if they just showed a clip of Colbert to people who were unfamiliar with the show, they couldn't always tell. The people who identified as on the left could tell, and the people who identified as on the right could not, which, you know, I don't want to draw any big conclusions that this is about sense of humor, but it meant that he was that good at fulfilling that role.
I want to play another clip. This actually goes back to 2004 when Jon Stewart went on CNN's Crossfire, that is, I think, is no more. But many consider this a really breakthrough moment for Jon Stewart. Let's give it a listen.
I made a special effort to come on the show today because I have privately amongst my friends and also in occasional newspapers and television shows mentioned this show as being bad.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that that wasn't fair, and I should come here and tell you that I don't, it's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America. So I wanted to
but
come here
defense,
today
let me,
and say,
wait,
I just,
let me,
here's just one, what I wanted to tell you guys.
Yeah.
Stop. Stop hurting America.
Okay, now let me.
And come work for us, because we, as the people.
How do you pay?
The people, not well.
Better than CNN, I'm sure.
But you can sleep at night. See, the thing is, we need your help. You're right now you're helping the politicians and the corporations, and we're left out there to mow our lawns.
You just said we're too rough on them when they make mistakes.
No, you're not too rough on them. You are part of their strategies. You're partisan, what do you call it, hacks.
And that's a scene, kind of a breakthrough moment for Jon Stewart there. What's so interesting, Sophia, is that he is deadly serious.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that sometimes would confuse folks to, you know, try to understand and unpack what was Stewart's mission. The reality is that there were times when Jon Stewart simply came out and would say what he felt. He wasn't being satirical there. He was just being straightforward because he really cared about the nature of the news media and its impact on public perception. But at other times, he really just wanted to be a funny comedian. And that can often confuse folks where they, you know, wanted to pin him into one role or another.
Do you think it's also playing that role of, you know, the king has no clothes, sort of exposing people for their, in certain cases, hypocrisy or their lies?
Well, that's what satirists do. I mean, that's their stock and trade. Right. I mean, if you don't have any hypocrisy and you don't have any folly and you don't have any inflated egos, then you don't have any satire. There's nothing for them to mock.
As you said, this sort of seemed to coincide with the rise of cable news and I guess the rise of the pundit, you know, the expert that opines about, you know, everything from vaccines to the war in Iraq.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. And in fact, That's been one of the worst outcomes of the 24/7 news cycle, because what you need your public to do is get the news and think about it and talk about it over dinner or with friends or, you know, at work the next day. Too much of the news today is already talked at you, right? So that's why Stephen Colbert said on his very first show, right, I'm going to talk at you, for you, on your behalf, because we'd seen so much punditry take over the opinion forming of the public. And so you were getting your opinions fed to you in these kind of vicious, divisive ways. So that was part of what Stewart was going after with Crossfire.
I'm looking at the title of your book. Is satire saving our nation? Is it?
I believe so. I mean, I think that satire has become without, you know, we have, again, pretty conclusive research on how satire has performed a vital role in helping maintain and inform citizenry. That is one key piece. But it's also done in a very special way. It's allowed us to rethink citizenship so that we can have fun. We can comment on Twitter. We talk in the book about the citizen satirist.
Right.
It's the production of satire among citizens that helps them think through their political positions. And that's actually a very good thing for democracy.
And I guess enabled by tweets and the internet, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, we have cases of folks that have satirical Twitter accounts. They're not professionals, right? And they have 180,000 followers. This is not a small thing. This is a very, you know, I ask people, I say, you can't really go a whole day without coming across some kind of satire on your Facebook, on your Twitter. And a lot of that is actually produced by average citizens.
About a minute before our first break here, but does that change policy? Does it get people to vote? Does it really engage people in our political system?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. But we have some real research on that, too. I mean, mock the vote, which is a Twitter hashtag, in fact, is that blend of, okay, yes, we're standing in line to vote and we're sending out tweets. So the idea that it would be one or the other, I think our research is proving that's not true.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Sophia McLennan is our guest. She's a professor of international affairs and comparative literature at Penn State University, also founding director of the Center for Global Studies. She writes for Salon and for Huffington Post and has a book called Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery in American Politics. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I see comments coming in on our Facebook page and also on our homepage. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and you can join us by calling 1-888-477-9499. Is there a favorite episode that you think kind of encapsulates what satire, the good that satire is doing for the country? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sophia McLennan. She has a book, a relatively new book called Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery and American Politics. I want to play another clip from The Daily Show. This goes back to 2009. Jon Stewart is talking to Brian Williams after the death of Walter Cronkite. And we begin with Brian Williams' voice. Let's give it a listen.
We lost a great man last Friday night, John. I thought that,
cannot
might
be your segue.
Educate.
Is that
I
your
thought
segue?
That might educate our segment tonight. You and I have had a
Are you talking about Billy Mays?
Tortured relationship.
We have had a tortured relationship. You're right. I enjoy sparring with you. You're right. Walter Cronkite was a giant in the industry. Is that a man you looked up to? Is that a man who
the guy I wanted to be when I was a kid.
Yep. Really?
Yep. For it was like Carrot Top to you.
So, how does it feel to fall so short? Do you think Walter Cronkite would be happy with what he sees now on the nightly news? Do you think that the reputation that he has is deserved and all those...
Oh, on the network evening newscasts, I think he was generally happy that, to use his phrase, we protected the news. He was not... I was in touch with him in his later years, and he was not terribly happy with the trend in the industry. He used to always talk about the encroachment of entertainment in the news business.
He didn't mention any names, though.
And that goes back to 2009. And again, Jon Stewart and Brian Williams talking about Walter Cronkite. And I'd be curious, Sophia, when you listen to that, what do you hear?
Well, you know, I mean, that clip just has so much irony today in light of the recent revelations about Brian Williams' integrity. I think that it reveals Brian Williams to be much more of a performer than folks ever wanted to recognize. And it also reminds me of the fact that back in 2007, Jon Stewart tied with Brian Williams and I think Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather as the most admired journalist.
Mm. And when he says to him, sort of comparing him to Walter Cronkite about him falling so short. I mean, it is interesting to hear them trading insults, Carrot Top and et al. But also the humor involved in it as well.
Well, yes. I mean, that was one of the trademark features of Stewart's interviews, a lot of banter. And it was interesting because over the years, he took a lot of flack for that. Folks saying, well, you know, this interview isn't really cutting to the core. And he softballed this. And, you know, even looking back, they might say, well, why didn't he really stick it to Brian Williams? Because the part that happens before that clip is Stewart mentioning that there had been, you know, sort of a revelation of an email scandal that Brian Williams was trying to avoid dealing with, right? Mm. So the thing is that again and again, it's back to this question of, you know, is Stewart being held accountable for certain kinds of news standards, or is he allowed to be both a comedian and a comedian that's helping put pressure on the news, right? So I think, you know, people look back and you might remember that Meet the Press was attempting to have Jon Stewart come be their host. And that, you know, the point there is that that's not what Stewart wants to do. He does not want to be a journalist. He wants to be the guy that gets the journalists to do their job.
We have an email from Peter. He says, why satire? Because the world, especially the world of politics and the pronouncements of politicians, can be so daffy, so ridiculous at times, and of even peril or horror that it requires. His email sort of falls apart. But basically saying politicians are a big target and they sort of do this to themselves. And it's people like Jon Stewart and Colbert and others who point it out.
Well, that's true. But if you don't have them doing that, then before you know it, the public actually thinks that talking that way or being a hypocrite or, you know, promoting your career instead of doing your job is perfectly normal. I mean, satire's entire mission, right, is to reveal folly. And so when there isn't any folly, then there's nothing for the satirist right to do. But that, you know, you could say, well, the reality is that between the politicians and the news media, Colbert and Stewart just had the easiest gig. You know, they just woke up and said, okay, what crazy thing happened today that I can, you know, talk about on my show? But you have to remember that at the time that these guys really rose to power, it was right after 9/11. It was a real low point when people didn't feel comfortable questioning government. Folks were losing their jobs. Journalists were getting fired for asking the wrong kinds of questions. Satire is a really important part of public discourse because it allows you to ask tough questions and often, except for in Bill Maher's case, right, keep your job while you do it.
Oh, interesting. Are we then in a kind of golden age of satire, would you say?
Absolutely. In fact, it's global, as we know from the case of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, but also because we've got a lot of evidence of satire really playing an important role in places like Egypt and Palestine and Iraq. Iraq has a state-sponsored television show called State of Myths that is a regular satirical show that mocks ISIS. The rise of satire is a very, very important way for the public to sort out anxieties, to find a way to express their distress over, not just folly, right, but abuses of power. And really, it's everywhere. I mean, we could talk about the movie The Interview and the impact that had, too.
Let me play another clip. And this is actually Stephen Colbert. This goes back to 2006. He was hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner, standing on the dais, a Bush on one side, the press in front of him. And let's give a listen.
Over the last 5 years, you people were so good. Over tax cuts, WMD intelligence, the effect of global warming, we Americans didn't want to know, and you had the courtesy not to try to find out. Those were good times, as far as we knew. But listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
And again, Stephen Colbert from the 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner. And Sophia, I remember watching that on C-SPAN, and the amount of discomfort in that room. You can hear that a little bit on the clip. Yes, a couple of chortles from the press, but most people were stone-faced listening to him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a real watershed moment. And what it also taught us was that the audience wasn't in the room, right? Within hours of the C-SPAN video going up, an individual put the whole clip on a personal website.
Ah.
That was viewed by millions of people in the first week. C-SPAN wanted to take it down. There was a lot of drama about the actual sort of scandal of the performance itself. But the people, the fans, took over. And it really changed Stephen Colbert's career. And it changed it partially because this was the first time that the U.S. public had seen anybody even come close to saying those kinds of things to our president at the time, to his face, right? I mean, having those images and photos of how uncomfortable George Bush is standing by Colbert was very satisfying to people who felt that had been, this was a president who had lied to the public.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Sophia McLennan, and we're talking about her book is Satire Saving Our Nation, Mockery and American Politics. We've been playing clips from Stephen Colbert's Colbert Report and also from Jon Stewart, the Daily Show, two of the most prominent satirists that we have, at least working in television today. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a website comment. This is from Allison. She says, is the guest familiar with the British show Spitting Image from the 1980s, which used caricatured puppets to satirize British politics and the royals?
I'm not, but it sounds like I should be. I mean, sadly, it's not really possible for me to be aware of all of the different kind of great examples of political satire out there. But I'll definitely look that one up.
Let's see what Beverly from Harrisburg has to say. And Beverly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd like to know why Sophia thinks that there are no right-wing political humor shows, and I don't remember ever of knowing of one. I go back to That Was the Week That Was, way back in the day, and I love political satire, and I don't know of any right-wing political satire.
Well, let me see if Beverly, thanks for the call. Sophia, are we talking about largely liberals doing satire?
No. Yes and no, right? So the short answer is your caller is right. We don't have equal examples, but we certainly have plenty of examples of conservative satirists. The reason, though, why we tend to see satire skew more towards the left is that satire's whole gig is to question the status quo. So if your political beliefs are that the status quo is good, you don't really have the same ground for satirical commentary. We certainly saw plenty of mocking of Bill Clinton, like buckets of it from both sides, right? Because that was an easy thing to do. We've seen quite a bit of mockery of President Obama, but that's not satirical comedy, right? Mm. It's not political satire. It's just trying to make him look stupid, which, you know, isn't really the same kind of comedy.
So the status quo doesn't necessarily mean who was in the White House.
No, the status quo, again, I mean, these are the things that are very, very complicated. But in general, what we talk about when we look at the political affiliations of satirists is that, you know, satirists want to get at the truth, which one might suggest isn't a particularly partisan issue. But they also want to expose faulty logic, et cetera. So lately, at least in the last, say, you know, since the Vietnam War, we've seen a lot more of that coming from sort of the left side of the spectrum for a lot of different reasons. It doesn't have to be that way, though.
Let me play another clip. This goes back to 2007 from the Colbert Report when Bill O'Reilly is talking about working at Fox and in conversation, obviously, with Stephen Colbert. Let's give that a listen.
Who's got the best parking space over at Fox, you or Hannity?
Hannity has a really good parking space.
He does?
Yeah.
Could you take him in a fight?
I want to fight. We're Irish guys.
You're Irish guys. You don't want to fight.
Hannity. No. See, this is a cliche now. You don't want to. Come on. Now, Hannity kicked my butt.
He would?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I'm a feat.
You got the reach. Tail the tape. You've got the reach.
I'm a feat. I'm not a tough guy. This is all an act.
You're breaking my heart,
sensitive.
Bill.
Sensitive. I'm a
if you're an act, yeah. Then what am I?
Ooh, it's right. Sophia, this is all an act, Bill O'Reilly says.
Yeah, well, he did say that, and yet he sort of comes in and out of whether or not he wants to admit it. He also said it when he did the debate with the mock debate with Jon Stewart. This is back to what you said about the pundit. I mean, it's an absolutely astonishing thing that the U.S. public is willing to sit still, right, and have people tell them what to think about things. Mm. It's not a good thing for our democracy. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly is one of the most interesting characters because, you know, sometimes he takes extreme positions on his show. But at the end of the day, he also was, especially with Jon Stewart, willing to go and sit down and discuss things. And there were moments when it seemed as though he was stepping outside of that performative space and really willing to talk about the impact of some of his racial comments, et cetera.
I think it's so funny that Stephen Colbert is talking to him about parking spaces and fighting with Sean Hannity. I mean, just asking really impertinent questions, but revealing in their own kind of way.
Well, then, and also important to remember that Colbert stole the microwave from Bill O'Reilly when he went on the show. So there was a lot of like silly pranking, and that's the important thing to remember. And I think one of the reasons why Colbert and Stewart could get so far in their satire was because they had that boyish, charming, silly kind of frat guy thing they would do. And again, I mean, some of our more sort of caustic satirists don't get away with that.
Calling him Papa Bear. I mean, that was his term of endearment for Bill O'Reilly.
Right.
We have an email from Paul. He writes, I think that Tina Fey's dead-on satirical evisceration of the candidate she satirized actually had an effect on the election. And, of course, talking about Sarah Palin. How do you see that performance?
Oh, well, your listener is absolutely right. There's also research to prove it. So it's not just our kind of gut feeling. When Tina Fey, basically the reason why Tina Fey was so effective was that she just repeated what Sarah Palin had said. She didn't change the text of Sarah Palin's comments, she simply repeated them. And that was devastating because, in fact, what Palin said was absolutely incomprehensible. So it was the end of her. It was the end of that candidacy for sure.
Do you think it's time? I mean, with of course, we have Larry Wilmore, who has his new show, I guess, replacing Stephen Colbert's show. And of course, the question is, who will be doing The Daily Show, if anybody? Do you think it's time for a girl?
It's always time for a girl. I think there are quite a few female comedians that could step into that space. I have to say, though, that as a big fan of satire's impact on democracy for our nation, my interest is more in finding a comedian that will go after the news headlines and the political foibles more than, you know, what their sort of, you know, identity happens to be. One of the important things about Jon Stewart's show was that he had such a cast of correspondents from a range of backgrounds. But these people, their contributions, you know, Jessica Williams is amazing on The Daily Show, not because she's a black female comedian, although that's just great. It's that she's a brilliant comedian, period.
And a brilliant interviewer in many ways. And it always just amazes me how people can reveal, meaning their guests, can reveal themselves to be the whatever that they are.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a very, very interesting way, a sort of format in those interviews where the person being interviewed gets completely disarmed. And we saw Colbert do it. It's a real strategy that they have. And a lot of it has to do with the kinds of questions that they ask and how they push. If you're a geek like me, you literally study each turn in the interview. It's the questions that they ask that the person is not expecting to hear. And it gets them out of their performance, right, so that they can no longer protect themselves. And the next thing you know, they say something completely outrageous.
Very disarming. Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about satire, the importance of satire, the role of satire. Our guest, Sophia McLennan, has a book called Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery in American Politics. We have a lot of people that want to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can always send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a quick recap. Last December, Stephen Colbert ended the Colbert Report. Last week, Jon Stewart announced that he was retiring from The Daily Show sometime later this year. These two comedians' sophisticated use of satire has exposed hypocrisy and mendacity in politics and the media. We're talking about the role that they have played in and the importance, the power of satire. And again, our guest is Sophia McLennan. Let me play another clip. This is from The Daily Show. This goes back to 2009. And Jon Stewart is talking to CNBC's Jim Cramer. Let's give it a listen.
I can't reconcile the brilliance and knowledge that you have of the intricacies of the market with the crazy bull I see you do every night. That's English. That's treating people like adults.
How about if I try it?
Try what?
Try doing that. I'll do that.
That'd be great. But it's larger forces at work. It is this idea that the financial news industry is not just guilty of a sin of omission, but a sin of commission, that they are actually in bed with this idea.
No, we're not in bed with them. No, I don't think that's fair. I think that we try to report the news.
And it sounds like, Sophia, Jon Stewart is doing to CNBC what he did to CNN.
Oh, yeah. Well, that Jim Cramer interview was really a huge sort of moment in Stewart's career, and the back and forth between the two of them that went on after that particular interview was also a very big deal. At the end of the day, a lot of folks think that it was Jon Stewart that was one of the only sources of, you know, really accurate reporting on the financial crisis.
Let me get, looks like Ethan from Kennett Square to join us on Radio Times. Ethan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm interested in how those who are being satirized respond to being satirized. And I think there's an instance that comes to mind, which is the Book of Mormon as a piece of art, which is hugely satirical, and probably you could argue that it's very mean-spirited or not, depending on your point of view. But certainly the LDS Church could have responded by screaming about blasphemy or you know, some kind of really really vehement response. And instead, what they did was to put ads in the playbills that said, you know, the book is always better than the play or something like that. So they responded with their own brand of humor instead of getting angry about it. And I think probably that played very well. That is, I think probably people thought better of the LDS Church after that. That's my thought.
No, it's a good thought, Ethan. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Sophia, I mean, it seems like a very clever use of humor on the part of the Mormon Church.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, at the end of the day, that's a, you know, that will play a big role in how people respond. When you are the butt of the joke, so to speak, not everybody is so gracious about it. But as we know, responding violently to satire tends to reflect badly on the person who's been satirized, right?
Sure. And unfortunately, we have much too much of that. Let me get Matt from, looks like, Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. And Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, love the show.
Thanks.
You know, I'm kind of a libertarian bent Republican who likes to listen to NPR and Al Jazeera to get a different point of view. So I'm not surprised when you call or say, I have absolutely no idea of any kind of, you know, conservative satire, because I find that my liberal and conservative friends are equally myopic about each other's political point of views nowadays. So, you know, shows like internet shows like Newsbusters are very satirical. People should just check it out.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Go ahead, Matt.
Stewart, though, I love his comedy. It's fascinating that a guy who was a bartender at the Gardens in Trent, a seminal rock club, became a comic and then got a show and became the voice of, you know, millennials, which is fascinating to me. But I think you're right. He both likes to be serious at times, and then also he goes right into being a comic. But I think that creates some conflict, and sometimes he gets a little twisted, and this is the point. And I point to his recent commentary regarding Brian Williams. It was, you know, this is an issue that to most people is just very simple regarding the gentleman's behavior and what he did. But in his commentary, John Stewart's commentary was full of just moral relativism and obfuscation. And I think it was because he was trying to mold both his personal views and the comedic together, and sometimes he just missed the point. So, he's great at panting the king, like you said. You know, the king is so close. But sometimes I think there's a conflict there because he's not one or the other, where he does miss the point.
Okay, Matt, I appreciate your point, and let me give our guests a chance to respond. And it does get tricky when someone who is either a friend or a friend of a show gets himself in trouble and, you know, people expect you to say or do something. In the case we're talking about Jon Stewart and Brian Williams. Sophia?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think sometimes this is also a matter of perspective. The reality is that it wasn't Jon Stewart's job to tell us what to think about Brian Williams, and it wasn't his job to decide whether or not Brian Williams should have a career as a news reporter anymore, right? At the time, I think he was pretty clear that he thought that Brian Williams hadn't been honest. And maybe that was all that needed to be said. I want to go back, though, to one thing that your caller said, because one thing that's important to point out, whether we're talking about the partisan affiliation of a comedian or not, is that, you know, folks like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert did indeed go after the Democrats. They, you know, consistently did pieces critical of Obama, Nancy Pelosi. You can find it. It's not subtle there. So, you know, satire isn't always as partisan as folks think, because it's a question, if they're doing a good job, they're going to go after whoever's in front of them. And, you know, again, with Brian Williams, I don't think that Stewart was that soft on him. And I think the Walter Cronkite interview, too, was pretty harsh.
Matt, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I have one more clip that we want to play. This is a 2010 clip from The Daily Show. And Jon Stewart is talking to four 9/11 first responders. And it was in response to the fact that Congress didn't approve a bill that would address some of the medical issues that they face in response to their work in New York City after the 9/11 attacks. Let's give it a listen.
Gentlemen, you're all 9/11 first responders. you were down there from the moment of the attacks, for the most part. Now you see the Senate is filibustering the bill. What's going through your mind as you're watching this process go down?
We're disgusted. We're disappointed, and mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we're hurt. We are proud protectors of the Constitution, for the people, by the people.
Right.
And we want to know where it was lost.
We're patriots to this country. It's like everybody here. We went down there for the love of this country and for the love of our city.
Right.
We didn't turn our back on anybody. For us to be here now, 9 years later, still fighting just for our health.
And again, a clip from 2010 from The Daily Show. And Sophia, here's Jon Stewart using his bully pulpit to really shed light on a serious issue and taking it very seriously and giving voice to people who were in many ways voiceless.
Well, that's one of the things that made his satire so unique. The reality is that there were times when both Stewart and Colbert intervened directly into the political sphere with the purpose of, really changing the course of things. Stewart, many people think that the bill would never have passed without Stewart getting behind it. There's lots of times when Stewart's been a really strong advocate, too, for vets. With Colbert, we had him opening a super PAC and effectively teaching the U.S. public about how campaign finance works. This was a pretty novel feature of contemporary satire, where it's just engaging more and more in direct action.
Let me get looks like Russ from Princeton, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Russ, go ahead. Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I think the single piece of satire I've heard in my lifetime that played a role in saving America was Stanley Kubrick's great movie, Dr. Strangelove, which satirized the concept of mutually assured destruction. And the character, I guess satirized, but Torchy Scott played, it was satirizing Curtis LeMay, Big Bomber LeMay, who was heading the Strategic Air Command, and comments like, gee, I wish we had more doomsday machines because I'm worried about a doomsday gap. And now, Mr. President, I'm not saying we're not going to mess our hair, but what I am saying is 10, 20 million casualties tops, depending on the brakes, really did a effective job of pointing out just how ridiculous the concept of just keeping acquiring more and more nuclear missile, nuclear bomb capacity so that we could blow up the world 10 times and the Russians could only blow it up 8, really helped, just bring about nuclear bomb reduction treaties. And maybe it's a little reason why we're all still around here today.
Well, Russ, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It is a brilliant movie. And, Sophia, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think what your caller's pointing out is that one of the unique features of satire is that it exposes faulty logic, right? So in the case of, look, this is all going to be great because I have more bombs than you do. And then somebody says, we're talking about bombs, right? That's what the satirist does. And that's been, again, a reason why we saw satire playing such an important role in public discourse in our country after 9/11. And that's why we're seeing satire playing such a major role, for instance, in the Middle East as they're dealing with ISIS. It's important to call out other realities, right? And say, look, the narrative as it's being fed to you by those in power is wrong. Let's think about this differently. And that's what satire does all the time.
I want to sort of acknowledge the sophisticated level of writing on those two programs as well, where you have Colbert coining the word truthiness, the Daily Show using Mesopotamia, to talk about the war in Iraq. And some of this stuff is so gosh darn clever, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, puns are one of the sharpest pieces in the satirist's, toolkit, because they're smart and funny and fast and portable. And that's why they're great for Twitter, too. You know, the other reason why those guys could do that so easily is also because of the absolutely ridiculous stuff that you see on cable news. I was watching midterm elections. I watched some on CNN. And, you know, John King walks up to the magic wall. The magic wall. I'm like, this Walter Cronkite would not be happy with the magic wall. We don't need a magic wall for election results. So at some level, too, what you saw on The Daily Show and The Colbert Report was exactly riffing off of the kinds of things that are already being fed right on the cable news shows. You know, the whole The Word segment that Stephen Colbert did was a complete parody of Bill O'Reilly's, you know, no spin zone, where he says something and then the text next to him is exactly what just came out of his mouth, in case you needed another version, right?
I think I remember a magic wall when I was in kindergarten, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I think our massive attachment to satire is a sign of how massively people in this country are suffering from the pain of cognitive dissonance in so many vital areas. And just a few quick ones. People are living longer than ever, but the programs to support a healthy and happy old age are falling apart. People go to college, but they have to enter indentured servitude to pay for it. There's more technology than ever, but our personal information is getting out. And things are more messed up in some ways. People finally get a job with health insurance, but they have $50 and $100 copays.
I'm gonna stop you there and just thank you for calling into Radio Times. And I mean, I think we've always lived in difficult times, and perhaps what makes this time unique is that we know about we're bombarded with information, with news, with punditry. So no matter where we go, on our cell phone, on our computers, on our radio, TV. Sophia, any thoughts?
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, satire always emerges in moments of political crisis. There was a lot of satire at the moment of the American Revolution, for instance. Right. But we do have some unique features today. And one of them is, as you point out, our ongoing access to information. But the other really amazing thing that I love studying is the fact that we are also in a place where citizens themselves can produce information and satirical information, right? So now you have people, they might watch that little clip of something on their phone and then they tweet something satirical about it. And that tweet, who knows how far it'll go? There's a there's an example of a tweet that was read on the congressional floor during the government during the debates over the government shutdown. So we have something we've never quite seen before, right? Where citizens themselves can say something and it can have that kind of impact.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Sophia McLennan, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a professor of international affairs and comparative literature at Penn State University, founding director of the Center for Global Studies. We've been talking about her book, Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery in American Politics. She writes regularly for Salon and for The Huffington Post. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program, including how to find us on Facebook and how to follow us on Twitter and how to download a podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.